In the past 3 weeks, we have been studying the Satipatthana Sutra. This is a record of an early teaching of the Buddha, which tells of the great importance and power of mindfulness, and it gives us detailed instructions of what to be mindful of and how to do it. Mindfulness is a practice of being present with what is happening right now, paying attention moment to moment to our life as it unfolds. There are four aspects of our lives that we are directed to become intimate with, and these are called foundations or establishments. The first three, which we covered in the past 3 weeks, are one, the body. Being mindful of the body and the body by noticing our breathing, posture and movement, the parts and elements that make up the body, and also being cognizant of the stages of decay of the body as it returns to earth. The second foundation is that of the feelings, being mindful of our immediate, spontaneous, and often subconscious reactions to anything we perceive. And these are positive, negative, or neutral. You could also say we like, dislike, or are neutral about everything that happens to us or that we are aware of. And these little reactions could be happening hundreds of times a minute as we move through our life. These feelings, or vedanas, give rise to our thoughts and actions, and they're based on our past experiences, our memories, our culture, and our learning. The third foundation is the mind. A mind is consciousness, the field of awareness in which perception and reactivity is taking place. In this foundation, we notice the condition or quality of our mind, how we are being mindful, how we are paying attention. With careful observation, we note our states of mind and our moods. Are we submerged in the qualities of lust, hate, or ignorance? Are our minds scattered or collected, focused or dispersed, open or contracted? Is the mind capable of reaching a higher state or not? Throughout the sutra, in following every explanation of the foundation and all of the mindfulness practices that are given, there's a refrain that is repeated about 13 times in the sutra, and it describes how we are to be mindful. So we are reminded by this oft-repeated refrain to observe every aspect internally, externally, and both internally and externally. This helps us not to take things too personally. We're told to observe the coming to be and the passing away of all things. Nothing is permanent. Our mindfulness is not just noticing what is there, but noticing that it comes and goes. Nothing lasts. We are told to establish mindfulness that the body or the feelings or the mind exist. For example, there is a body here. Just to the extent necessary for knowledge, without interpretation, judgment, or stories. So not getting lost in associations and reactions. Just noticing the body. The last line of the refrain states, "And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world." This refers to not being attached to any of our arising experiences, either through craving or through our views. Just going to read from an author named Eric Harrison with some of his understanding and description of being mindful of the mind. He's an Australian meditation teacher who practices and teaches in a secular fashion. He's very clear that he is not a Buddhist and actually is quite judgmental about the religion of Buddhism, as he describes it, but he's very well versed in the teachings of the Buddha and has great respect for them. He tends to use slightly more contemporary language and images and understanding of modern psychotherapy and cognitive science. So I found his writing quite helpful. The Buddha's strategies for managing states of mind is as follows. Name the state of mind Notice how it arises and passes away. Notice what precedes it and understand its causes. Observe the whole dynamic in others. Avoid triggers and cultivate prophylactic habits. Construct situations that support positive states in the future. All these strategies can help stop us from drifting into bad states in the future and help us gradually dissolve them when we do. They also help us boost the good states when they are present and helps keep them around longer than usual. If we check our states of mind regularly, we will find that we're rarely at our cognitive best all day long. We often have to cruise on automatic. We find that good self-monitoring thought is hard to maintain, and it decays rapidly under less than optimal conditions. Here are some causal factors that the Buddha would want us to recognize. Our capacity to think clearly suffers if we are stressed, if we are over-emotional for any reason, if our brains are overloaded with more information than they can comfortably handle, if we've made too many decisions in the preceding hours, or if we are physically tired. If we are mindful of these states of physical or mental depletion, we will also see what helps and what doesn't. Pushing on regardless or having another cup of coffee are usually dodgy strategies. And that's just a bit of Eric Harrison's comments on what he feels the Buddha is saying about how to practice mindfulness of the mind, or states of mind. And just to focus again a little bit on the first foundation, which is mindfulness of the body. A lot of time is spent on this in the sutra. Being present and at home in the body is crucial as we go forward into exploration of feelings, states of mind, and thought. The body is our anchor. It connects us to where we are in time and space. We are here. This is now. Using the breath to calm the body promotes relaxation and comfort in the body. The grip that anxious and scattered thoughts have on us is loosened. We have time to examine them, see their origins and how they dissolve. When we are tuned into the messages we get from the body, we know more about our feelings and moods. There are so many physical sensations that accompany feelings and states of mind, like muscle tension, posture, sensations in the gut and chest, feeling hot or cold, rapid or shallow breathing. So if we listen to the body, we can notice when needs arise or get feedback right away if something is not in our best interest. And then we can make adjustments. Through the repeated practice of observing something as it arises, as it persists, and as it fades away, there is an insight that comes. Joseph Goldstein wrote an article in the Lion's Roar about the Satipatthana Sutra, and I'm going to read what he wrote about this. There is an early insight into the nature of the mind-body process that both comes from this continuity of mindfulness and also strengthens it. It is the understanding through one's own experience that in every moment, knowing and its object arise simultaneously. There is the in-breath and the simultaneous knowing of it, the out-breath and the knowing of it. A visual object arises, and in that very moment, there is the knowing of it. This is true of every aspect of our experience. This insight is the first doorway into the understanding of selflessness, and in the stages of insight, it is called purification of view. We begin to see that everything that we call self is simply this pairwise progression of knowing and object, arising and passing, moment after moment. And we also see that the knowing in each moment arises due to impersonal causes and not because there is some abiding knower. So we can say that knowing, or consciousness, arises spontaneously when the appropriate causes and conditions are present. Going even deeper, we see that the knowing faculty is not altered or affected by what is known. And this realization has liberating consequences for both our meditation practice and our lives. In meditation, as we go from painful sensations to pleasant ones, we see that the basic quality of knowing is not altered. It is simply aware of what is arising. So at this point, we're just going to, I'm going to invite you to do a small guided meditation to put attention on the body and to notice how body, feelings, and mind are not separate, even though in the sutra the foundations are separated and we adjust our focus from one to another, but they interact all the time. So if you're comfortable, I will invite you to stand. And as you stand, just tune into your body, be aware of it. Feel your feet on the floor. Be aware of your skeleton, of all the bones supporting you. How it feels to stand. You can notice any balance adjustments that you're making. And notice your breathing, the whole length of the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath. Breathe into the whole body. Calm the body with your breath. And start to notice all the sensations of your body. What is it telling you? Notice your posture. Does it relate to your mood or to your state of mind? Your energy level? Can you be aware of any physical sensations related to feelings, to those positive, negative, or neutral reactions, or to your mood right now? Where are they in your body? Breathe into any tension, discomfort, or pain that you might be having right now. Just let your breath go to that spot. See how it vitalizes it, brings life to it. Breathe into any part of your body that holds fear, worry, or anxiety. Breathe into any part that is calm and peaceful. And notice where that is. Your head, chest, elbow, heels. Now sit down slowly and carefully, noticing how your legs move, what happens to your spine, where your hands and arms place themselves as your balance and position changes. There is a body here. Thank your body for being a body today. And think for a minute, what do you do to help you be mindful of your body in your body? To help you feel the joy of being alive and present in a body? Giving kindness and care to the body can make it easier to maintain intimate awareness with it. Some examples of this would be having good food, enough but not too much. Exercise, where you can feel the heartbeat fast and your breathing quicken. being in nature, absorbing the freshness of mountain, ocean, or forest air, feeling the energy of the wind or the moon, the support of the solid earth, maybe getting a massage, having a comfortable bed and a good sleep, sex in any of its forms with a partner or not, hugs from people or animals, or the simple pleasure of breathing in a long or a short breath. All of these things can increase your ability to be mindful of the body in the body. For although what we're learning through mindfulness and in this first foundation is that the body is impermanent, it's made up of borrowed elements, and it's going to rot when we die. It's not solid and unchanging. It's not separate from everything else. In this lifetime, while you are alive, it is your body to take care of. It's your ticket to this physical earthly realm, with all of its opportunities to learn, grow, and enjoy. As Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. So now moving on to the fourth foundation. This one is somewhat tricky to describe and understand, at least for me. Last week we talked about how difficult it is to define mind. What is it? Where is it? As words and concepts don't always fit well. The third foundation has us become aware of the state of our mind. The fourth foundation is called mindfulness of objects of mind, sometimes defined as mindfulness of thoughts. In Buddhist psychology, the mind is the sixth sense organ, and the objects of the mind are the sense objects corresponding to the mind. Just as smells are the sense objects corresponding to the nose, sounds to the ear. The objects of mind are every concept and everything that belongs to the sphere of memory and mental experience. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, ignorance or delusion is the erroneous perception of things. In order to correct our erroneous perceptions, the Buddha teaches us a method of discriminative investigation, which relates to the establishment of the mind and the establishment of the objects of mind. That's the third and the fourth foundations. The objects of mind are also called dharmas, or all that can be conceived of as existing. So in the fourth foundation, we are going to be mindful and investigate all that can be conceived of as existing. Wow, so how do we break this down? Well, it is done for us in a manner of speaking in the sutra. In the fourth foundation, we are led through a series of the Buddha's teachings, and we practice becoming intimately familiar with them in ourselves. The list is as follows. The five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six internal and external sense spheres with their corresponding consciousness, which is also called the 18 realms, the seven factors of awakening, and finally the Four Noble Truths. So this could seem like a lifetime of study. So beginning with the five hindrances, these are desire, anger, lethargy, agitation, and doubt. So these are things I think all of us are quite familiar with. I'm going to read again from Eric Harrison about the five hindrances and the style in which we are instructed to become mindful of them in the sutra. So from the sutra, he lives observing the five hindrances. When his mind is caught in desire, he knows this is desire. When his mind is free of desire, he knows this is the mind free of desire. He carefully observes how desire arises and passes away, and what causes it to do so. He learns how to extinguish desire when it arises, and how to prevent it from arising in the future. In the same manner, he examines the four other hindrances, namely anger, lethargy, anxiety, and despair. He sees how they arise and pass away and what causes them to do so. He learns how to extinguish them when they arise and how to prevent them from arising in the future. So Eric Harrison has another bit which I'm going to read, but I found quite helpful in understanding the whole sort of shape of these practices of mindfulness with respect to objects of mind, and in particular right now the five hindrances. The Buddha suggests that we name a painful emotion as the first step toward controlling it. As it says in the sutra, when the monk is angry, he knows this is anger. This implies that the monk has already arrested the tendency toward action, and he's not trying to fix the discomfort. He's trying to see that cluster of body sensations and turbulent thoughts as objectively as possible. The sutra goes on to say that the monk carefully observes how anger arises and how it passes away, and what causes it to do so. If the monk continues to observe his anger, he will find that it is bound to change. Emotions are like weather. They may fade quickly or slowly, but they can't maintain their initial intensity forever. The non-reactive watching mode also allows the monk to see how emotions naturally change. He observes how anger passes away. His blood pressure drops, his muscle tension fades, and he feels mildly embarrassed about getting so worked up. If the monk notices this dynamic hundreds of times mindfully, it gets embedded in memory. Remember that the etymological root of sati is memory. This inevitably predisposes him to be less vulnerable to similar aggravations in the future. He will remember that he just has to wait long enough or preoccupy himself with something else for a painful state of mind to fade. This is a good result, but there's still far more to this therapy. The monk also trains himself to notice how anger arises. Through repeated acts of observation and memory, he gradually realizes what triggers his bad mental states. He observes how anger arises and how it passes away, and what causes it to do so. This will help him notice danger signs quickly and develop prophylactic habits in the future. In psychology, this is called the early detection of destructive tendencies. The monk will eventually realize that certain things reduce his propensity to anger. These may include sufficient sleep, reflecting on his goals, being around supportive people, chanting the texts, and above all, maintaining the habit of continual self-observation that is the Satipatthana method. The monk will also learn to recognize the mind that is free of anger. Buddha asks the monk to notice a sign of his success that is actually a non-sign. This is when he doesn't get angry in situations when he did in the past. A psychologist would recognize this as desensitization, or the extinction of a habitual response. Another instruction in the sutra reinforces these insights. He observes this both in himself and in others. As social animals, we love to watch others, to speculate on motives, to try to read people's minds. In this way, we learn far more about human psychology than we would from navel-gazing alone. The Buddha encouraged the monk to learn about the universal nature of emotion in this way. I think from hearing these words and the interpretations by Eric Harrison, we really see how comprehensive these teachings of the Buddhas were to help us to really be aware of the objects of our mind and to be able to cultivate the ones that we would like, how to be aware of and decrease the propensity for negative states, and how to cultivate positive ones. So we've done the five hindrances, and the next thing in the sutra is we apply the same formula with regard to the five aggregates, which are also called the five aggregates of clinging. And through studying this, it helps us to see the falseness of our sense of being a solid, separate being. We see the emptiness and interdependence of all things. I'm reading the sutra now from Thich Nhat Hanh's translation, which is in his book called Transformation and Healing. Further, the practitioner observes the objects of mind in the objects of mind with regard to the five aggregates of clinging. How does he observe this? He observes like this. Such is form, such is the arising of form, such is the disappearance of form, such is feeling, such is the arising of feeling, such is the disappearance of feeling, such is perception, such is the arising of perception and the disappearance of perception, such are mental formations, arising and disappearing, such is consciousness, arising and disappearing. And after this, we go through the six sense organs and six sense objects. So this would be eyes and form, ears and sound, nose and smells, tongue and taste, body and objects touched, mind and objects of mind. And again, with the same strategy or formula applied with how to be mindful. So I'll read just one of them, not all six, just in the interest of time. The practitioner is aware of the ears and aware of the sound, and he is aware of the internal formations which are produced in dependence on these two things. He is aware of the birth of a new internal formation and is aware of abandoning an already produced internal formation. And he is aware when an already abandoned internal formation will not arise again. So what is being referred to here by internal formation? The word in Sanskrit is samyojana, which can also be translated as knots or fetters, agglomeration or binding together. So these are the thoughts and feelings that are triggered by the input we receive through our sense organs. The thoughts and feelings that arise upon hearing something or seeing something or tasting something. Our senses are our doorways to the world around us. We receive input through them. We form a perception which leads to an interpretation. And this interpretation can sometimes behave like a knot or a fetter. It can be based on our previous experiences, beliefs, karma, moods, etc. We're learning to notice the internal formations, how they arise, how they pass, when they're abandoned, and when once they're abandoned, they will not arise again. So we've examined now how we are affected by the five hindrances, learned how to calm them and prevent them from recurring. We've studied the five aggregates and the six sense spheres. So through this, we become friends with the concept of emptiness. Buddhist psychology talks of seeds as the basis of every state of mind and the content of our consciousness. There are unwholesome seeds and wholesome seeds in us and around us. So through examining the five hindrances, learning how to reduce the number of unwholesome seeds associated with them, through examining the five aggregates and learning to let go of our separate sense of self, through examining the sense fields, learning how to recognize and eliminate internal formations or fetters, we've now created a fertile field to explore the last two sections of this foundation, which are the seven factors of awakening and the four noble truths. And these are ways to sow wholesome seeds to encourage positive qualities and states that produce joy, equanimity, and liberation. So the seven factors of enlightenment are the ideal meditative qualities of mind for attaining enlightenment. And these are mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And the same strategy or formula is described in the sutra for the fostering of the seven factors of enlightenment. read again from Thich Nhat Hanh's translation. Further, bhikkhus, the practitioner remains established in the observation of the objects of mind, in the objects of mind, with regard to the seven factors of awakening. How does he remain established in the practice of observation of the seven factors of awakening? 1. When the factor of awakening, mindfulness, is present in him, he is aware. Mindfulness is present in me. When mindfulness is not present in him, he is aware. Mindfulness is not present in me. He is aware when not yet born mindfulness is being born, and when already born mindfulness is perfectly developed. So again, it's noticing the arising, the passing away. Noticing when it's not there. And that's an interesting one. We notice when we're not mindful, which sounds kind of tricky to do. Because as soon as we notice it, we're being mindful. And then lastly, we've got the mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths, which are the sort of foundation, really, of Buddha's teachings. Further, bhikkhus, the practitioner remains established in the observation of objects of mind, in the objects of mind, with regard to the Four Noble Truths. How, bhikkhus, does the practitioner do this? He is aware this is suffering as it arises. He is aware this is the cause of suffering as it arises. He is aware this is the end of suffering as it arises. He is aware this is the path which leads to the end of suffering as it arises. So, with all of these things to be mindful of and to study and learn, would you think that the Buddha would tell us how long it would take to practice and perfect all of these teachings? That's actually what happens the very last part of the sutra. And I was surprised when I read it and greatly encouraged, because it's not what you would think. It's not gazillions of lifetimes. So listen to this. Bhikkhus, he who practices in the four establishments of mindfulness for 7 years can expect one of two fruits: the highest understanding in this very life, or, if there remains some residue of affliction, he can attain the fruit of no return. And that means being free of needing to keep having cycles of rebirth. So that, you know, that's quite encouraging, just 7 years, but it goes on from there. Let alone 7 years, bhikkhus, whoever practices in the four establishments of mindfulness for 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, or 1 year can also expect one of two fruits: either the highest understanding in this very life, which means enlightenment, or if there remains some residue of affliction, he can attain the fruit of no return. Then it goes on kind of like a backwards auction. We get to whoever practices for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, or 2 months, 1 month or half a month can expect this. And then lastly, let alone half a month, bhikkhus, whoever practices the four establishments of mindfulness for 1 week can also expect one of two fruits. So it's interesting that we go through this time frame, and I think it's really telling us a few things. One, that it isn't really a matter of time, how we practice, how we become mindful enlightenment, but also we are here in this frame of time, and not to get too discouraged in a way by the volume. We can learn, we can be mindful right in a moment. So at the end there, it looks like the goals, maybe, if you could say that, for the sutra are to become enlightened, which I think maybe this is something we all have to some degree, however we define that. I'm going to read again from Eric Harrison about what he says about the goals of the sutra. So he says, what is this path of training for? The sutra has two goals. The first goal is upekkha, equanimity or tranquility, which involves a high degree of emotional and philosophic detachment from the world. Above all, it implies the end of suffering now and in the future. Upekkha is certainly attainable, and similar ideals are found throughout Western philosophy and early Christianity. Achieving this is the task of the first three foundations of mindfulness: mindfulness of body, feelings, and states of mind. The second goal is nirvana, which is complete enlightenment. The monk can only achieve this through profound insight into the Buddha's theory of existence. This is the task of the fourth foundation of the sutra, mindfulness of thought. And I've noticed as we go through the foundations of mindfulness, it's really clear that these practices are coming to the forefront in secular life. Mindfulness is an everyday word and practice, and being aware of feelings, thoughts, and actions very much aligns with therapies such as cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy, which are in common use now in psychotherapy. And it's so interesting that these healing modalities were put forward by the Buddha so many centuries ago and have been practiced for such a long time before penetrating modern culture. So did they come through because of Buddhist teaching and practice? And how is Buddhist practice different from modern secular mindfulness and therapy? I think there are some important ways. In our Buddhist practice, one could say there is no goal. I'm not sure this is true completely, as the Buddha does teach ways to use our awareness to cultivate good and to end harm. In Mahayana Buddhism, we vow to save all beings. But the Buddhist teachings emphasize emptiness, the understanding that there is no separate and permanent object or self. And this leads to the understanding of interdependence. Modern therapy helps us know ourselves. In a similar way, so does Buddhist practice. But the intent is different, in a subtle but profound way. In Dogen's Genjo Koan, this is made very clear. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. So thank you very much for listening, and may we all go forward in our practice of the Buddha way together.